We have two things due. Well, December 7th, we have the final exam, the testing report. After that, on the 9th, we have Friday, I want you to return FPGA, interface board, and any spare components from the interface board to me. And I'm going to make that worth 25 points on your grade on the challenge. If we get 100% completion of SAIS, it'll be purely extra credit, 25 points. If we don't, it'll be 4 credit, 25 points. Okay? Make sense? So if we get to 100%, it'll be 25 out of 0. If we don't, it'll be 25 out of 25. As long as you do it. Okay. We do have a homework due this Friday, homework 9, which was extra credit. Just want to clarify in case anybody missed it, because it's a little bit weird to have a homework out at the same time as the final. I had them both due Wednesday. Wednesday is a study day, and I'm not allowed to do that. So I gave out the final early and made the homework due late. It's the reason why they overlap. So I apologize for that, but it seemed the fairest thing to get things off of Wednesday. Okay, questions? I give out the password to access the final exam at the end of the lecture today. It's posted on the website now, but the exam itself is password protected. So if you have any questions prior to seeing the final, get them in today. If not, what I'm going to do today is give one more example of this discrete time small signal modeling, and then move into kind of some course conclusions and further topics in this area. Sure.
Is it really only in the high frequency range that we should see a difference in the body plots for the average model and the discrete time model?
No. It's really only when you have significant high frequency dynamics going on, but those dynamics can reflect down into low frequency. The pure difference between if I took the same model and I either averaged it or I did kind of a discrete time model, the difference would only show up at high frequency. The caveat to that is, when you have high frequency dynamics like resonant switching transitions, there can be dynamics about the converter behavior that are lost when you average them away, and those can show up at low frequency. And I'll give an example of that today, but it depends on how you're simplifying your model to get down to the average model. So if you include everything all up until you get the final transfer function, then just average it, then yes, only as you approach the switching frequency would they differ. Which finds that often, in addition to that averaging, you're doing things like small ripple approximation and doing things like neglecting dead times, and those can have an effect all the way back at DC. And this first example show that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Anything else? So last time we went through and we finished up our derivation using this discrete time modeling technique of what a small signal, linearized but discrete time controlled output transfer function would look like. Morphed into the discrete time here, we had something that looked like x hat is phi times x plus gamma times d. And looked at an example of that using a buck converter. I want to show another example today using a DAV converter. So the goal here is to take this DAV and derive a similar discrete time equation. Here I changed from phi and gamma to f and g because in the DAV, phi is my control. So I didn't want to have phi be that matrix and confuse things. But same thing, just different letters form. So with this DAV, I go through the same process. This is a high step down DAB. So I neglected these caps because they contribute negligible dynamics on the high current, low voltage secondary. The ZBS transition is really fast. But what I wanted to do is incorporate VP as a state. VP is this voltage here. It's made up of contributions of the states of all of these four CAGs, same way we do in state-space modeling. I can look at the four of them as an equivalent cap across that input ridge, because those four states are not linearly independent of each other, and I can back out from that to what each of those four caps are. So I've got a three-state system, my input bridge voltage, inductor current, and output voltage. And here I'm again doing a plot kind of like we used to derive this discrete time model, where I'm modeling the progression of the states, x of t, where x is this three-variable vector, but I'm plotting it kind of looking like the inductor current in the DAB. Mine, this is fairly conceptual. So I'm assuming that my sampling instance is here just before the primary dead time, and I go through one full period. So my x of n would be here. My x of n minus 1 would be here. And my t hat of n minus 1 is the phase shift applied during this interval with any small signal perturbation on it. Okay. So to do this for the DAB, I look at state space equations during every switching subinterval. In subinterval 1, the resonant dead time on the primary, I get something like this. I go through and do this for all of the three subintervals in the first half period. I get circuits that look like this. It's either a capacitor or a voltage at the input, and the output is connected either positive or negative, depending on the state of the secondary bridge. And for each of these circuits, I now have a LTI equivalent circuit, and I can write a state space equation describing that circuit. So I get A1, A2, A3, B1, B2, B3. My input is just the input voltage, VG. I have this three-state vector that I mentioned. Okay, so to look at the state propagation, I again take the state space equation at the top. I solve it directly, and then assuming my input is approximately constant within one switching period, I can get this closed form expression for how states propagate within one switching period, and this applies repetitively for each of my switching periods with the appropriate AIs and BIs. So I go through and begin applying that. I can look at my state propagation matrix. This is the component of X hat due to just propagation in the absence of any kind of input. So the same kind of plot here, I have some perturbation in the states at the beginning. I track how that propagates through each of these subintervals to give me some perturbation on the states at the end of the period. In this case, I now have 6 subintervals in one complete period. So I go through each of these and my what was 5 before, what is now f, it's like the exponential of 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So I let it propagate through all of those. For my forced response, I look at a perturbation in my phase shift, and that's going to happen at this time at the end of my phase shift interval. So if I look at the steady state states there, I call it XP1, and I increase the phase shift, what's going to happen is I'm going to propagate for a little bit longer in my phase shift interval instead of propagating in my kind of power delivery interval. So here I've already linearized those exponentials. What I get is this perturbation XD1 is the matrix from subinterval 2, this phase shift interval, minus matrix from subinterval 3, my power delivery interval, times the states at this point, times that time perturbation. There's this TS over 2 pi that's just converting from a phase to a time. So that gives me the perturbation here. I now need to track that through to the end of the period. So from this point, the perturbation XD1, I let it propagate through interval 3, 4, 5, and 6. So I get this kind of a contribution to, so my chi XD1 hat is this XD1 hat propagating through the rest of these subintervals. In the DAB, however, I have 2 phase shift intervals per period. So now I need to do the same thing for the second phase shift over here. That's also going to increase if I increase the total phase shift for this period. Now I get another perturbation that propagates through just subinterval 6, just the final subinterval. So I get the second term looks similar, but propagates less, yeah.
So when you're finding XD1, mm-hmm. state 2 is changing length, right?
Right.
Why is e to the a sub 3 not in that equation? I could be misunderstanding something, but I would expect it to.
I apologize for that. So there's a notation thing here. This is an inconsistency in my slides.
I rename the subinterval. Subinterval 3 is the secondary dead time, and I'm not including that because it's so quick and contributes negligible dynamics. That's why the E to the A3 dropped out of there, because it doesn't exist, and that's actually 4.
So there's an inconsistency here. If I kept these named 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, then this should be 3, 4, 5, 6.
I'm missing one regardless. Okay. So that's an error.
Okay.
So, neglecting that for the moment, what I get is these two terms, one which is the perturbation of the first phase shift propagated through, one which is the perturbation of the second phase shift propagated through the end of the period.
And then I have, combining this with my natural response, I get my complete equation that looks like this. So the natural response is F, derived just as a result of perturbation of states, and the forced response as a result of perturbation in the phase. Okay. This looks messy. This is what I get if I control the DAB with one phase shift per period, but because the DAB is half cycle symmetric, we looked at, I have the option to control per half period. So I can actually control this thing at double the switching frequency by adjusting a phase here, then calculating a new reference command for my regulation, and then adjusting the phase differently at the second phase shift interval. If I do that, then I only need to model half the period. So if I go about that, I can
rederive my equations as they would look for the half period. So B is, I will
come back here, for example, for the forced response, I'll have this XD1, I'll propagate it through to this point, and then I'll stop. So I start here, and I end up here.
The problem is, for my next period, my states haven't matched up. I put polarity here because everything in my tank is anti-symmetric, right? If everything's balanced, then this point should be the negative of that point.
So what I can do is insert in this transition matrix.
Call I sub HC an identity matrix for that half cycle, which inverts my IL and DP because they are anti-symmetric, but my DO is symmetric across the half cycle, so it just keeps it. Okay.
So what that does is it takes a model from this, I propagate through, I get to this point, and then it's going to make it negative so that I can start the next period and do the same thing.
So it's kind of flipping this and taking out that anti-symmetry. For VO, I don't need to do that. I start here, propagate through, I end up back where I should be. This allows me to cut out kind of the second half of this entire model, which already was the exact same thing, just with negative signs littered throughout. So it's the same subintervals, primary dead time, phase shift, power delivery, but all with primary and secondary flipped. So that simplifies my model down. I now have a model that looks like this. It's again a discrete time model. The difference here is N is an index in my half cycle. So this is sampled at TS over 2 instead of sampled at TS. And I can control this thing now at twice the switching frequency. Make sense? So if I do this, the example I was mentioning earlier, I can look at how the results of this discrete time model compare to two different things here. My circles are experimental measurements of a prototype 100 watt DAV. That's low power, 30 watts, and high power, and then magnitude and phase of the Bode diagram. And then I'm comparing to this square wave model, which is not purely the average model. It also neglects those switching dead times to make the averaging tractable analytically. So it assumes that my dead times are zero, and I just have this kind of linear trapezoidal current. Okay. What you can see is that the discrete time model is significantly different from the square wave model that neglects the resonances. And the discrete time model matches the experimental results almost exactly over a wide range. Okay. There is significant difference here, even at low frequency, between what I get when I neglect dead times and what I get when I include them. This was a 1 megahertz converter. So those dead times were fairly significant. They occupied some 10% of the switching period.
What do you measure the frequency response?
So we did this one. I put a controller on board that allowed a perturbation signal in, and I varied the phase shift according to that perturbation signal. Perturbation signal, I made a sinusoid of small amplitude and varied the frequency. And then I looked at the output, looked at the component of it at that frequency. That's why these points die off a little bit below the switching frequency, because once I hit up the switching frequency, I can't really even differentiate switching ripple from the response to that perturbation. As long as the perturbation is lower frequency than the switching ripple, you can kind of pick out the Fourier component due to that perturbation. So it is really measuring VO hat divided by V hat. So this is in the frequency domain, looking at these same two points in the time domain. Here I have inductor current and output voltage from the same 30 watts, 90 watts, comparing measurements of the converter to the discrete time model. And one thing to keep in mind in this discrete time model, here at 30 watts, it kind of looks like it gives you an envelope, but that's because the discrete time sampling is always at the peak of the current. Here at 90 watts, you can see I'm always sampling at the end of the power delivery interval here. So this peak goes higher because my model is not looking for an envelope, not looking for a max or min. It's looking for the states at a specific time. So it's always at the end of this interval. You can see it matches up well with what the inductor current is at that time. Models
the dynamics in response to a set change in phase shift of small signal value. So it's a powerful tool, makes it nice to derive A, things that are correct at high frequency, but also kind of simplifies incorporating some of these complex dynamics that would be very difficult mathematically to incorporate into a average model, because I can't get a closed form equation that I can take a derivative of in order to find its linear response to different variables. Here, I don't need that. If I know the matrices, I know the solution. Okay. One thing I've mentioned, and I do want to just kind of give some side notes on, is what happens with uncontrolled switching in this model. So I have, by going to these switching subintervals, I've removed all of the switches from my circuit. And as long as I know when I jump from the circuit in subinterval 1 to the circuit in subinterval 2, I'm fine. Okay. But with something like a diode here, so I've got a buck converter, asynchronous switch on the top side that's controlled, but then it's uncontrolled diode. If I get my dead time wrong, if I model this and I say T2 is some dead time that's larger than the real dead time the converter would have, what my model is going to predict is that my switch will look something like this. It's going to, because it no longer knows that there's a diode there, it just has this passive equivalent circuit, it has no problem letting the switch node continue resonating down below zero, shown in red here. And that's going to result in some error in my predicted states. Okay. Black is what the actual waveform should look like for the same operating point. So I have shut off my FET here. My model predicted too long of a dead time. So it has this error that also then goes back and affects my output current. So now I have a different amount of volt seconds applied to the inductor. So there's all this negative volt seconds here in this error that are going to decrease the inductor current. Okay. So this can happen if you go through and solve the entire converter operation and make sure you solve the correct dead time in the presence of all ripple and all non-linearities, then you can get the correct time and then you don't have to worry about this. But if you had to go through and solve the complete converter operation, you lose a lot of the benefit of this approach, right? So the other option is, just kind of qualitatively, in this model, I derived from the state space equations. So I already know x dot everywhere. What is the rate of change of the states? And if I simulate and I get something like this, and I see that the voltage went negative, and I know some error in that state should have never gone below zero. So it's negative 10, I've got 10 volts of error in that. And if I know an error, and I know a rate of change, I can figure out what my delta T should be to get this back to this black waveform, right? So if I've got a slope, and I've got a final value, I can find the time. So what it would be is kind of an iterative process. If I don't know the dead time, I haven't solved for it, I guess one, see if my states have any error. If they do, I know roughly how far back I need to go, how far I need to change these times in order to get the states to have no error. And because this is a somewhat computationally efficient method, I can do a MATLAB in a very short time. If I have to re-simulate two or three times to get everything mashed up, get my diode behaviors in there, no problem. Bit of a side note, just want to mention this and can talk more at length about how this is implemented if anybody's interested. Okay, so that was the example I wanted to go over today. And what I want to do is just discuss some high-level conclusions from the course and then give a few examples of future topics. Okay. So one of the big things I stressed early on in this course and wanted to leave you with this is really, when is high frequency power electronics a good thing? And the answer is that high frequency is never a good thing. Creates all these problems, makes the analysis more difficult, creates a bunch of EMI, gives me issues with switching loss that I need to address. It is not in itself a good thing, but it's rather a pathway towards some other goal that you have. So I would never say you're building a buck converter, you should make it 10 megahertz. Okay? But rather I would say you're building a buck converter and you find that at 10 kilohertz, got okay efficiency, but your power density is awful because your inductor is way too big. Then you should investigate how increasing that switching frequency to change the size of your passives can potentially lead you to a smaller converter. Right. So these I've sketched previously. This is what's been popularly termed a Pareto front optimization, where I look at efficiency and power density, and I find for a given design, as I vary switching frequency, in this direction is increasing switching frequency. What does my trade-off look like between efficiency and power density? And typically, for a given design, particularly in DC to DC converters, going up in switching frequency will give me benefits in power density by reducing the size of my passives up to some given maximum. After which, trying to further increase that switching frequency is going to cause me to get diminishing returns. It's going to cause my efficiency to decrease due to additional switching losses and my size to increase because my magnetics, I don't have core materials that can handle that frequency, so they have to get bigger because my heat sink has to get bigger to accommodate all these additional losses. So somewhere on this portion of the black curve is my optimal design, which point on there depends on how much I value power density, how much I value efficiency. If I don't care about size, I want the most efficient converter possible. Power loss is my number one concern, almost always going to be driven towards very low switching frequency and huge passives. These types of curves exist and can be derived for a kind of constrained design where I say, you have these devices and you can choose how many you want in parallel and you have this core material, but you have to make your inductor in this way and you have this topology. As I start to look at varying that between different topologies, different materials, different devices, I'll jump on to alternate curves, this blue and red one. But in all cases, I'll have this sort of a shape. Within a given design, I'll have some trade-off, some region of interest over which increasing switching frequency helps me in certain metrics. Here I'm comparing two things, efficiency and power density, but if I start to include cost and reliability, if I start to include the EMI filter into the design, it's going to change how my trade-offs look. So what I want to stress as a takeaway from this course is switching frequency is just a knob to turn. Okay? And there are useful things you can get out of that. But it's not something you crank just for fun. Another thing is, okay, when are the techniques of this course useful? Here I'm showing waveforms of, again, a DAB converter. The converter is the same in all cases, but I'm varying the switching frequency from 100 kilohertz to 5 megahertz looking at the waveforms. At 100 kilohertz, this red line, everything's linear. I have a square wave on my primary. I have a trapezoidal wave current. My resonant intervals occupy a negligible portion of the switching period. I would not bother with any kind of state plane analysis, any kind of worrying about what's going on during the dead time in this 100 kilohertz space, because it's not going to affect my overall converter behaviors. Right? Maybe I go back in and just see, am I going to get CBS? Yes, no. But I probably don't even care because those losses are so small at that low switching frequency. But certainly in terms of converter dynamics, in terms of control, this looks like a square wave, that looks like a trapezoid, and that's going to be an adequate model. As I start cranking up the switching frequency and going towards this 5 megahertz, now my dead time occupies some sizable portion of my switching period. And it's going to have these effects
looked at in that previous example, it's going to change my control, it's going to change my steady state solution. I'm not going to get an accurate model of this converter if I don't directly address the ZBS resonant interval in my model. Either through discrete time modeling, through state plane analysis, through any of the other techniques discussed in this class. So, somewhat qualitative in terms of conclusions there, but when do you need to do this stuff? Well, whenever it's significant. But it's not every single converter now you need to be doing state plane analysis. You go back to your 10 kilohertz buck converter from 481 and say, let's see how state plane analysis would have affected this. It won't. Okay. Only when you're pushing up enough that these behaviors are significant in your waveforms. All right, with that said, where do you go from here? Just want to mention a few different topics and kind of further directions in power electronics. First, I touched on a couple times, start looking at very high frequency VHF power electronics. This is an example of some work from MIT on 110 megahertz converter here. These things are well suited to some of the analysis we talked about with discrete time modeling. That modeling, as I mentioned before, kind of moves you away from design-oriented analysis where you can get a direct solution, you can rapidly solve for the steady state operating conditions, but you've got this big matrix equation, and if I didn't get the output voltage I want, I don't have many choices for how to adjust the converter design other than perturb and observe, tweak L, and see if that gave me better waveforms. So the design of these is really kind of at the boundary between RF design and power electronics, looking at a system as waveforms being a sum of harmonics rather than being a time domain wave shape. And where can I add things like second harmonic filters to improve my wave shape, make it look more symmetrical, more trapezoidal. Some interesting work going on in this area. It would be what we've somewhat led towards, but kind of beyond the scope of this course. One thing we didn't address is switch capacitor conversion, particularly with some of the goals we mentioned as why we go to high frequency, things like high density. Switch capacitor converters can be a useful method to get there. So switch capacitor converters are things that at a base level have nothing but capacitors and switches, no inductors. And basically, this is a 3-volt, 1-volt switch capacitor ladder. Operate by, think of a 2-to-1-volt converter where I have a 2-volt input, I put two caps in series across that, they both get 1 volt on them, then I switch and put them in parallel at the output, they both have 1 volt, so I get 2 volts at the input, 1 volt at the output. By switching back and forth, I get a 2-to-1 conversion ratio. Inductors, as you've seen, often the largest and most difficult component in the power converter. So getting rid of them have definite advantages in terms of size. I can go potentially very high frequency with this. If I can minimize any minor switching losses that are left, but they should be relatively small to begin with because everything that we've talked about as far as overlap loss, all these other mechanisms assume clamped inductive load, right? Some current that has to go either through the high side or through the low side at all times. And as I switch, it's going through something that's not fully on. Here, I don't have any current biasing the system, so my switching is not going to look like this clamped inductive load. It's going to look like a voltage source resistor switching, which is much lower stress on the devices. Recently, something pretty complex when I'd be able to tell what's going on there. There's been investigation into hybrid switch capacitor and PWM converters, which kind of combine some of the benefits of traditional PWM converters with switch capacitor to handle the bulk of the conversion, allowing you to get high density, very fast switching speed, but eliminate one of the big issues with switch capacitor converters, which is fixed conversion ratio. If I do what I said before, stack caps and put them in parallel, I get 2-to-1 conversion ratio. And that's all I get. I don't get 2-to-1.5, I don't get 2-to-1.1, I have no real regulation capability. They can do a little bit by increasing losses, but that's a poor trade-off to have.
Another good thing is these are suitable to full integration. I want to look on an IC, inductors on chip are very difficult, whereas capacitors on chip can be quite good. So I can put this entire thing all in a single IC. CATs, which is associated gate drives and control. So I have a few references down here that are kind of some of the seminal works in switch capacitor, and then some further topics related to hybrid converters and more advanced switch capacitor analysis and optimization. Okay. Another topic, really looking more into the materials we use for power semiconductor devices. There is a discussion of this posted to our potential website, which I link here. Goes through, probably many of you have seen plots like this. For a given material, I can, based on some assumptions, derive, if I wanted to block this much voltage, this would be the best case on resistance per unit area that I can do in that device. Okay. This has this downward kind of logarithmic trend, indicating that if I want to block a whole lot of voltage, I need a big device to get the same resistance as a smaller blocking voltage device. Silicon is not the best. Why band gap materials are improving upon this? There is a fundamental limit to what you can do in terms of voltage on resistance and area. Okay. And that limit is derived on this website here. It's derived assuming just a chunk of semiconductor material that looks like this. This is a cross-section model of a Schottky diode in this case. But it also is a pretty good model of the drift region of a vertical MOSFET. Where I would have this large, lightly built region that's used to block voltage, but I need to kind of inject a lot more majority carriers. I need to turn it on to conduct. So it has this dual purpose of blocking voltage and conducting. And analyzing that, I can get the limits of any majority carrier device. So this is kind of a 1D current would flow in this direction. Typical way what we do called BD models. This over here, by including this deep well of P-type semiconductor material, this creates what's known as a superjunction. Due to some reasons that have to do with how the electrical field expands, that I don't have time to get into on just this one slide, superjunction devices are able to kind of bypass the limit that I would get from a typical vertical diffusion MOSFET to allow me to block higher voltage with less material. But similarly, the limits for this type of structure can be derived assuming arbitrary geometries. I still know okay, there's a fundamental performance limit for what I can do with silicon devices. I can do better with better materials, gallium arsenide, silicon carbide, gallium nitride, diamond, if you got lots of money. But from this analysis, knowing the fundamental limits of the semiconductor material, I can go about the process of deriving the fundamental limits of a converter using devices made from those materials. So what is, if I want to block 10 volts, I can figure out in silicon to block 10 volts, I have a defined trade-off between what my output capacitance will be and what my on resistance will be. Now I can analyze what's the theoretical limit on how efficient I can do this converter. Digital control design is something I would have liked to get more into. Now that we have this discrete time model of our power suit that's already in the Z domain, that lends itself well to now the design of a digital compensator in the Z domain. So typically,
What we do as power electronics engineers is we model our converter in the S domain, our average model. Then we have the digital controller, the PSP or FPGA. And I design some digital compensator by taking the analog compensator I want and doing an S to Z conversion. There are issues with that. I've neglected sampling behaviors of the converter, and now I'm neglecting them in the controller. So I'm going to have these compounding errors, and I'm going to see issues in my control loop that wouldn't have shown up in my analysis. But if I can model the converter directly in the Z domain, I can design my controller directly in the Z domain, kind of push towards the limits, have something more well suited to the application. And also look when we dig deep into digital control at other effects, such as how does quantization of A to B, quantization of PWM affect my converter operation. There are interesting behaviors like limit cycling have to do with if my A to D can only produce, you know, it's 12 bits, so I can't sense anything in between two of those bits. And my PWM is lower, it's 8 bits. I can end up with this case where I am jumping back and forth between two values in my PWM because the A to D always has error, and I can get what's called limit cycling at my output where it's just got this kind of low frequency oscillation continually. So, thank you all for attending lectures. Thank you for your hard work in the course. Good luck with your finals in this class and in others. Let me know if you have any questions similar to the midterm. I'll be available for questions of a clarifying nature or of a general content nature during the final. On a tiny box challenge, let me know how things are coming. You know, if you encounter issues, want me to come have a look at waveforms. And get them both in on time. Any final questions?